the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Los Angeles is just like any other big city that's been a COVID hotspot, largely still shut down, scraping the bottom of the barrel to come up with money to pay for stuff, and hoping that the federal government can lend a helping hand. Well, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti has all of those things and more on his political plate, and we'll ask him how he plans to organize that dicey dish. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm E. Martinez. Thanks for being with us. Coming up later on the show, what exactly is the Green New Deal? There are a few of them floating around, and what would it mean for California? But first, a sit-down with LA Mayor Eric Garcetti. He's a co-chair of Joe Biden's presidential campaign committee, so we'll get his take on how California Senator Kamala Harris did in the debate last night against Vice President Mike Pence. We'll also discuss the state of the pandemic here in Los Angeles. While the number of coronavirus cases in the city have leveled off since their height in the middle of the summer, but we aren't out of the woods quite yet, and we're still far from reaching the benchmark set by the state to fully reopen. So, Mayor Garcetti, we watched the debate between a VP arrival California Senator Kamala Harris and incumbent Mike Pence. There was quite a bit of dodging of questions from both sides, but what can you count as Senator Harris's best moment?
I think Senator Harris did an amazing job from the very beginning, focusing this on what this campaign is about. This administration's incompetence in responding to the greatest challenge of our lives, not just the pandemic, but the economic downturn. I heard a lot of lies and I saw a fly. So it was lies and flies for me. To me, it's just a very clear contrast that there's two people with the heart and the experience that we need versus a president who really has neither.
All right, let's turn now to the city's finances, because LA's budget could be short up to $400 million due to the pandemic. You're still working out a deal to furlough city workers, with the latest being that workers take two unpaid days off and get a floating holiday. How much would that save? And is that nearly enough?
Well, the furlough is still, at this point, we have about a $70, $80 million gap. So there's going to be other things we're going to have to do. And we're talking to all of our unions. We're talking to all of our leaders of our departments. Where can we put off programs, purchases, policies that we might have implemented this year? There's certain things we can't slow down. We can't slow down some of the work that we're doing, I believe, on racial equity in such an important year for racial justice. We can't stay away from those core services when you call 911 to make sure that police and fire, that sanitation and, of course, our trash gets picked up. So we're protecting kind of those core services while looking at what we can do with less. So we're going to have to close more of this budget. But let me say one thing. I was really, really disappointed, and I've been deeply involved in negotiations talking to Secretary Mnuchin and Speaker Pelosi directly last week. I was optimistic that federal government would recognize that it's really local communities, by the way, run by a lot of nonpartisan mayors who happen to be Democrats, Republicans, and independents, despite what the president says, who have our workers on the front lines, firefighters, who are fighting fires and helping people get transported, who have COVID-19, nurses and social workers dealing with the pandemic. And the federal government needs to step up and help state and local governments. And the president walked away from that, instead saying it was his priority to push through a Supreme Court nominee instead of helping yet again deal with this pandemic. That was really, really disappointing. And I hope that he will reverse himself, step forward, help our key industries like our airlines, our restaurants, and recognize that those who are on the front lines in local and state government also need that assistance.
Well, considering that President Trump stopped negotiations on any kind of stimulus package, are you moving forward right now thinking that that's not coming? That is not going to come right now?
We're absolutely not banking on it. We're hopeful always, and hope springs eternal. I will never stop being an extremely loud voice. I've organized a bipartisan group of mayors across the country, especially, I think for some of these senators that are up for re-election in key states, the Republicans who refuse to move forward, they also want a deal. And they need to know that this isn't a partisan point. This is about saving America. 12% of our economy goes through state and local governments. And if you let them fall off a cliff, if you let our restaurant industry further sink, our hospitality industry as well, we will see not just a downturn this year, but years from now, a hangover from this depression that we're in. If they take swift action, though, we could see a much quicker recovery.
Now, in the midst of all this, there's been a call to defund the police. Earlier this summer, you and city leaders aimed to cut the LAPD's budget by up to $150 million. The department winced at that, while Black Lives Matter leaders said it wasn't nearly enough. When you proposed that $150 million cut, what would that have actually meant? Because usually defunding police actually means reinvesting in communities or reallocating funds.
Well, I think the phrase is a tough phrase, not one that I've embraced because it means so many things to different people. As a longtime budget maker and budget writer, defund means when you zero something out, when you have nothing there. And I oppose that. I just think that's wrong and it's not the right way forward. Sometimes you want to make investments in crime prevention, community efforts. You want to change the training. You need resources to do that inside a police department to achieve the same ends I think we all agree upon. But the police department had a reduction like all departments have, to be clear. For anybody who thinks that it was a way to punish the police department, absolutely not. It's a tough budget year. And we have to, even in a tough budget year, invest that in things like what we hope to roll out soon, being able to do 911 calls 24/7 for mental health emergencies that don't just fall on the shoulders of our police officers. Why have we turned our police officers into 2 a.m., 3 a.m., clinical psychologists and social workers? It's not fair to them. It's not right for public safety. And so we need those resources to do that, to invest in very successful programs like our gang reduction and youth development programs, which have former gang members and youth specialists who intervene and prevent crime from happening. Wherever we've done that hand in hand with police programs, we've reduced crime further by adding civilians and non-police programs to the mix than just policing alone. So we didn't just wake up to that this year, but it's a tough budget year. Everybody has to take some of that cut in all departments. But we said it is a time to rethink, how do we make this better for our police officers? And most importantly, how do we make this safer for our community without having the disproportionate impact in communities of color that for so long have felt, even in a very improved police department where we've seen deaths at the hands of police officers plummet, where we're compliant with eight can't wait and some of the best policies in the country, where other cities come here to copy what we're doing. We still need to go further in a year like this that demands it. And so I'm proud that we're leading.
Talking to LA Mayor Eric Garcetti. Now, this week, California started a health equity requirement that would make counties have to reduce levels of the virus in most vulnerable communities before advancing to the next phase of reopening. Now, Mayor, seeing that Los Angeles is by far the largest city of the 88 in the county, a lot is going to fall on you before the rest of the county can hope to get out of this most restrictive purple tier. How fair do you think it is for the city of LA to shoulder that load?
Well, I embrace it because, equity has been one of the foundations of all the public service I've ever brought. I think that you can't just put policies out there without a lens at who's the worst off and who is the most affected. This pandemic's laid bare that in America and certainly in our city too, that there is disproportionate impact based on how much money you have, where you live, sometimes the color of your skin or the culture that you come from. But the good news is, I was just on a call this morning with the chair of the Board of Supervisors, Supervisor Catherine Barger, our public health officials, and the first assessment of our equity work in LA County was the best in the state. We're the first city in the country, I believe, and I put a strong focus on this to cut, for instance, African-American deaths, which were almost double the population, down to under the percentage of population in LA County. We put a strong emphasis in the diverse communities, not just doing things in English and Spanish, but in native languages for, native Latino immigrants who speak Spanish as their second language and English as their third. Looking in the Pacific Islander community and working with the Native American Commission at the state and county level to bring testing. We've really tried to make sure that equity informs everything that we've done. And I think it's one of the reasons in such a vulnerable city with the highest vulnerability index of any major city in America, we've had for that group of city, the lowest proportion of deaths from COVID-19. And we're not going to let up, because if you just put on your blinders and assume that policies will affect everybody equally, you will see higher deaths in those communities that are the toughest hit.
So, Mayor, can you say if the county of Los Angeles can't move up to the next tier, it won't be because of the city of Los Angeles?
No, Los Angeles City has led. We've actually been under, we're generally a little bit poorer than the rest of the county. We're more a little bit more diverse than the rest of the county population. And yet our numbers now for the last 4 months have been under our population percentage of the county. In other words, we've tested more of our people. We've had lower cases, fewer deaths, lower hospitalizations. I'm very proud of that. So LA County won't be dragged down by LA City. We're doing our fair share. And I'm very proud that LA City really broke down barriers between us. I talked to the other 87 mayors of LA County at least every quarter and probably about a dozen times during this pandemic I've convened us. And folks like Robert Garcia in Long Beach and Terry Tornick in Pasadena and so many different mayors, we work so closely together and we're doing tests for the entire county. We never ask you for your ID to make sure that you just live in the city of LA at one of our testing centers. We know we're one town, one LA. We all root for the same teams. We all enjoy the same weather. We all, you know, live in the same place. So we've really made sure that those boundaries are broken down and we're helping with equity, not just in our city, but everywhere.
Finally tonight, KPCC and the LA Times co-host a debate in the race for LA County District Attorney. There's incumbent Jackie Lacey, challenger George Gascon. Now, Mayor, you recently switched your endorsement from Lacey to Gascon. Why?
You know, they're both very decent people, and I want to say that, and I don't think LA can go wrong, but I've known George Gascon for 19 years. When I was a very young council member, I started working with him as one of the most senior people in Los Angeles Police Department, bringing some of the most important reforms to the department in the early 2000s. And we just became deep friends. He wasn't in the race at the beginning, and he is now. And he and I are more aligned with, I think, kind of a vision of the future that not only looks at the ways that you can keep communities safe through prosecution, but really looking at the things that haven't worked, you know, the kind of jail industrial complex and continuing to not have programs that intervene. And most importantly, that help with reentry when people come out of jail and prison. How do you prevent people from getting there in the first place? And how do you make sure that they don't return? And I've been impressed with the program that he has. And I've just known him. He's been a dear friend and somebody who I've looked up to for many years. And I think he'll be a great DA.
Now, one more final thing, Mayor. At the risk of jinxing it and being blamed for it if it doesn't happen, tomorrow the Lakers could win the NBA championship in one of the weirdest seasons any of us have ever seen. If indeed they do win the NBA championship, what's going to happen with a city celebration? Can there be a parade on Figueroa?
Well, you just put butterflies in my stomach because I think, like you, we've had, whether it's Lakers or Dodgers, so many hopes that have been crushed over the last decade and more. This could be a year like 1988. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves with the Dodgers, but it's looking great, obviously, for the Lakers. And as a lifetime Lakers fan, I know I'll be screaming my head off inside my house or in the backyard or wherever I'm going to be watching the game. We've been in close contact with the Lakers. And look, these guys have been in a bubble for a long time. I think they miss their families. They want to get home first and foremost and celebrate with them. And then we're talking to the Lakers about ways that we could celebrate safely, but in a way that lifts them up. This is an extraordinary team. I know I'm going to be lighting up City Hall in purple and gold and those pylons at LAX. And I hope we can come up with something creative, whether it's, you know, cars gathering someplace or whether it's all of us like we do for our medical personnel, stepping out of our homes at the same time across the city and listening to the city cheer as one, or a place where the players can go safely and we can watch them in iconic LA fashion somewhere and scream our heads off from where we are.
From 6 feet away from each other, though, screaming your heads off.
Exactly, from 6 feet away, or more if you're screaming, probably 10 feet is better. But I would just encourage people, you know, LA Live will be closed tomorrow. I know the LA Live folks are going to be announcing that and putting up K-Rail and things like that. Let's not set back the progress that we've made in this city just because we want to have one night of celebration. Let's make sure we get those jobs and our openings and especially our kids back in school. And I think the Lakers would want it that way. All of us would love to lift them up as one of the best teams we've ever had, but let's do it in a way that doesn't set us back.
That's LA Mayor Eric Garcetti. Mayor, thanks a lot.
You bet, Egg. Great to be with you.
The two candidates running for LA County District Attorney in the debate, Jackie Lacey and George Gascon, that will debate tonight starting at 6:30. It will live stream, and you can find that at laist.com. That's laist.com. All right, now to a goodbye, an Iranian singer whose voice was regarded as one of his country's national treasures has died. Ghost, I'm gonna run. That's Mohammad Reza Shajarian performing at an NPR Music Tiny Desk concert back in 2013. Iranian state TV reports say that he was battling kidney cancer for years now and had been hospitalized in Tehran. Shajarian was one of the biggest names in Persian music, but later in his career, he could only perform abroad after showing support for protesters following Iran's contested 2009 election, publicly asking state radio to stop playing his songs. He was a figure admired around the world, a beloved singer, especially among Southern California's large Persian community. Mohammad Reza Shajarian was 80 years old. More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm Ian Martinez. The vice presidential debate between Senator Kamala Harris and Vice President Mike Pence generated a number of headlines last night. But one term came that Pence brought up over and over was the Green New Deal. Now, here he uses it to paint a picture of the Harris-Biden ticket as against the American people.
They'd impose the Green New Deal, which would crush American energy, would increase the energy costs of American families in their homes, and literally would crush American jobs.
But in her response, Senator Harris didn't refer to that legislation. Instead, she said the climate change is an existential threat.
Joe is about saying we're going to invest that in renewable energy. It's going to be about the creation of millions of jobs. We will achieve net zero emissions by 2050. Carbon neutral by 2035. Joe has a plan.
All right, so what exactly is the Green New Deal and what does it mean for California? With us now is John Christensen, an environmental historian at UCLA and executive producer of a new documentary on KCET called The New West and the Politics of the Environment. John, if anyone knows anything about the Green New Deal, if they know like one basic thing, and you know they're probably younger than us, John, I think they'd say it was co-sponsored by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York. Can you summarize the key elements of this proposed legislation?
Well, the Green New Deal is not legislation. It's just a resolution calling for action, but it's radically aspirational. It wants to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions in 10 years while creating millions of high-wage jobs, investing in infrastructure and industry, promoting justice and equity, securing clean air and water, healthy food, access to nature, a sustainable environment for all. And oh yes, and provide everyone with high quality healthcare, affordable housing, and a guaranteed job. And for a resolution that never passed either House of Congress, it's really had a big impact on our politics.
Yeah, and just to be clear, the name is a reference to FDR's New Deal, which helped pull the country out of the Great Depression in the 30s. How is this New Deal like that one?
Well, the idea of a Green New Deal is really modeled on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal program, which was an ambitious set of legislation and executive actions, many taken in the first 100 days after his inauguration to pull the country out of the Depression. So the Green New Deal combines environmental programs primarily designed to combat climate change with jobs and economic recovery, very similar to the New Deal.
And I think that's why I might have confused it as legislation and not a resolution, because I think I went back to FDR's New Deal and made that connection. Now, Vice President Biden and Senator Harris, do they support the Green New Deal?
Well, Senator Harris was a co-sponsor of that Green New Deal resolution in the Senate, but the Biden-Harris platform doesn't go that far. It's a very ambitious platform. I would call it a lowercase Green New Deal, a package of programs that does most, but not all of what the uppercase Green New Deal called for.
Now, what about their actual climate plans? I mean, can you give us a quick breakdown on what the candidates are running on? How would those plans affect us in California?
Well, look, the Trump-Pence ticket is totally opposed to the Green New Deal, as you noted. They're trying to brand it as socialist and use it against the Biden-Harris ticket. They're in climate denial. They've pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. They have no plan for confronting climate change. Their platform centers on energy independence, and to achieve that, actually producing and burning more fossil fuel. It's the total opposite of what we're trying to achieve here in California. And by contrast, the Biden-Harris platform calls for spending $2 trillion over 4 years to escalate the use of clean energy and transportation, electricity, building, create economic opportunities, while tackling climate change in an equitable way, prioritizing communities that most need investment. The plan has very specific and aggressive targets and is very much aligned with what we are trying to do here in California.
Speaking with John Christensen, environmental historian at UCLA and executive producer of a new documentary on KCET called The New West and the Politics of the Environment. John, looking at California now, has any Green New Deal legislation come up in the state legislative body? And if so, what's been the outcome?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. In the last legislature, you know, that ran through the summer, Green New Deal legislation was introduced in the assembly by both Democrats and Republicans. The Democratic version aimed to tackle climate change with a focus on environmental health and economic justice for low-income immigrant communities of color. It didn't go anywhere because there wasn't much room for a lot of bills in this legislature because of the reduced state budget and the aftermath of the COVID-19 crisis. It didn't even get a hearing. A bill touted as a Republican Green New Deal, which would have taken money from high-speed rail to invest in greater LA's rail system, likewise didn't go anywhere.
John, the governor recently had some executive orders around the environment and climate change. Do those orders bear any resemblance to what we've been talking about, this Green New Deal legislation in the legislature?
Yeah, they really do. And it's not only the governor's executive orders, including his most recent mandate that all passenger cars sold in the state must be electric vehicles by 2035. It's also a whole series of climate legislation passed by the legislature and signed by governors since Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. This California way has become a model for the nation and the world, that it includes setting increasingly stringent limits for greenhouse gas emissions, mandating and incentivizing clean technology in a variety of sectors, from agriculture to transportation, and steadily transitioning to renewable energy. That's all the stuff at the heart of the Green New Deal.
Now, John, Los Angeles has a version of the Green New Deal itself. What does that entail, and is it actually in effect?
Yeah, it is. You know, our Green New Deal in LA sets a goal of 80% renewable energy supply by 2036, creating 300,000 green jobs, mandating a transition to all electric buildings and major renovations, recycling 100% of our wastewater, planting at least 90,000 trees, and, you know, especially increasing the tree canopy in low-income, severely heat-impacted areas of the city by 2028. And the city claims that we've met or exceeded 90% of the plan's near-term goals, and that LA is now the number one solar city in America. Greenhouse gas emissions went down by 11% in a single year, and that more than 35,000 green jobs have been created.
You know, wondering, John, there's AOC's Green New Deal. We've got LA's Green New Deal. It seemed like a lot of different places, Green New Deals were popping up everywhere. Do you think that's a problem when people want to identify what it is, that there are so many that have used the same name?
I think it's, you know, again, I think it's actually, you know, a good thing for, you know, an ambitious vision that really, you know, didn't even pass, you know, out of Congress. It has really had a big impact on our national discourse. And, you know, in the absence of leadership at the national level, you know, where we've been going backwards for 4 years, these Green New Deals, again, what I would call lowercase Green New Deals, have been happening in states from, you know, Nevada to California to Delaware and Maryland, you know, across the country. In the In the National Climate Assessment that was delivered to Congress last year, California has instituted more measures to curb climate change than any other state. But a lot of states are doing things.
And I just want to make it clear, in case anyone's wondering, the Green New Deal is not part of Joe Biden's climate plans, just to be absolutely clear on that. That's John Christensen, environmental historian at UCLA and executive producer of a new documentary on KCET called The New West and the Politics of the Environment. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
All right, moving on. The Bobcat Fire has been burning through the San Gabriel Valley and Angeles National Forest for more than a month. In that time, it's scorched more than 115,000 acres, leaving devastated homes, structures, and communities in its wake. A few weeks ago, we spoke to a resident of the Big Santa Anita Canyon Cabin Community. That's a historic cluster of hobbit-like homes located right at the base of the canyon. Ben Fitzsimmons told us then that due to the limited access, residents were waiting to find out whether their homes had survived. Well, this week, they finally got an update. Here's Ben. He's the head of the Homeowners Association.
It looks like about 20% of the cabins have been completely lost to fire, along with a number of outbuildings that are still being identified.
Now, due to the incredibly remote nature of the cabins and the uncertain environmental stability, owners say they still don't know specifically whose homes are still standing and whether they will be able to rebuild, a prospect that is both expensive and daunting.
What can be rebuilt? Some cabin owners may not be financially able to rebuild. It's not a cheap thing to do. Relatively speaking, they may be very simple cabins, but because the donkeys have to pack all the materials in, you have to pay per pound for all of the materials. So a bag of cement can be fairly expensive just to get that packed into your cabin.
Well, Ben and his neighbors own the cabins themselves. The Forest Service holds the lease, so it will be up to the agency to decide whether it's safe for those who've lost their homes to go back and rebuild in the base of the Big Santa Anita Canyon. When wildfires burn in Southern California, people need information that they can act on. Now, in the past, the information flow would be slow, relying on news conferences and the media to relay updates. And those happen only about twice a day. But the coronavirus pandemic has forced fire officials to adopt new ways to inform the public. KPCC's Sharon McNary has more.
Before the pandemic, when I needed updates on a big fire, I'd come to a place like this, a dirt parking lot lined with RVs, tents, and noisy generators. The Bobcat Fire headquarters at the Santa Fe Dam Recreation Area in Irwindale, where I'd talk to someone like this.
Hi there.
I'm Kristen.
Kristen,
nice to meet you.
Kristen Allison, a public information officer with the U.S. Forest Service. We duck inside a trailer to talk. She tells me that informing the public is very different this fire season. A lot of in-person interactions with crowds of press and public don't work anymore. So fire agencies have had to pivot to online.
We're all learning as we're going, and I think that we're kind of all in the same boat is because all of these things hit us at the same time.
They had been tinkering with various social media apps in the last few years, but the pandemic sped it all up. Last year's experiments are now this year's essential tools. Take the Bobcat Fire, the typical in-person community meeting where a few hundred people might pack into a noisy high school gym. That's been moved online via Zoom.
This is day 16 of the Bobcat incident.
That's L.A. County Fire Chief Daryl Osby addressing a community meeting about the Bobcat Fire. His audio quality is pretty bad, but other speakers were easier to hear. No matter, this meeting video, archived on the Bobcat Fire channel on YouTube, has been viewed more than 7,000 times. The channel also has updates in Spanish.
Hasta hoy, el incendio ha quemado aproximadamente 100,000 acres.
In video briefings on the fire's behavior.
Looking at Monrovia Canyon, we had a very active fire last night, back and down.
They're even making standalone videos to explain firefighter jargon, like strategic firing.
Wildland firefighters don't just use water. They frequently fight fire with fire.
Now, realize that the major pieces of information about the fire, how many people are assigned, how many acres or homes are burned, that still gets calculated and updated just twice a day. Dozens of experts have to figure that all out as a group, and that takes time and teamwork. But between those major updates, the information officers are pushing other bits of information out on social media, like photos from the front lines. And there's another reason for the more frequent messaging: tech. That's improving map making and information collection. In past years, fire maps were hand-drawn in the field by trained fire observers.
Every couple hours, they would drive to this area on the fire, and they would have to hand-draw that on a map. And that map was how we would get relayer information, how big the fire was, where it was growing.
Then they would manually transfer the hand-drawn lines into mapping software. It was laborious work, and the information got old fast. Now maps get made by people like Annette Navarre.
I'm a GISS, a Geographic Information Systems Specialist.
She's getting information from firefighters who record the latitude and longitude of fire lines on cell phones and send it back. Drones, helicopters, and airplanes collect other data from above, sensing where the fire is burning hottest.
We get information from infrared sources, and then we use that to create the fire perimeters that go into the maps that we create.
She creates different types of maps on paper and online, including where homes might be in the path of the fire.
Now, do you ever stop and think about who's seeing this at home or when they have to evacuate?
We do. I mean, one of the things we have is evacuation maps. So, you know, it's a matter of trying to make that as clear as possible, so that people can look at it and zoom in and know, you know, is my house in the evacuation area or not?
Then all of the maps, the videos, the briefings, the frontline fire photos, it's all parked on a user-friendly website called InciWeb. You can find your fire by searching INCIWEB and the name of the fire. Allison says the new tactics help people make better decisions this fire season.
When we're looking, as we've had on this fire, evacuation warnings and notices, they can make those decisions much more rapidly. They're able to look at their own personal decisions and figure out what they need.
And better, quicker decisions can save lives. Covering infrastructure, I'm Sharon McNary.
Teenagers on TikTok are becoming political influencers, breaking stories, making waves, and making their really famous moms mad. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. During this unusual election cycle, some people who cannot vote are actually having an outsized influence on politics, and we don't mean Russian hackers on this. Now, we're talking about teenagers. Teenagers like Claudia Conway, the 15-year-old daughter of White House consultant Kellyanne Conway. You see, Claudia broke the news that her mom had tested positive for COVID-19 after Kellyanne Conway had first claimed she was negative. Then her daughter broke the news on TikTok.
You've caused so much disruption.
Disruption?
You lied about your mother about COVID?
No, Mom.
About COVID?
It's how I interpreted it.
You're taping me again?
That was real, by the way. Be it TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, social media is now a fact of our social and political lives. Joining us to unpack how what's happening can impact the election and beyond is Karen North. She's the director of the Annenberg Program on Online Communities at USC. Karen, so let's start with that example of Claudia Conway. Aside from it being a window into maybe a little bit of family dysfunction there, she's using TikTok. A lot of young people are using TikTok to show maybe a middle finger to authority, even if that authority is deeply connected to the White House. Karen, what have you learned about how Americans too young to even vote use social media in politics?
I mean, we have to remember that's the age of, you know, development in the teens and 20s when people feel very passionately about causes. And if there isn't a political topic to protest, then people will you know, protest the food in the dorms. And so, you know, we remember that that's a group of people that are really key to our understanding of what is, you know, what is upsetting people or what is energizing people. And now what we've seen evolve over the last 15, 20 years is that the young people have these vast networks, this huge sort of broadcast system where they can talk to each other in really engaging, entertaining ways and spread the word about things that they care about.
Yeah, and if you have a connection like Claudia does to a famous person like her mom, Kellyanne, then all of a sudden you're going to have even more eyeballs than any normal kid on TikTok.
I mean, she's emerged as pretty much of an influencer anyway. And so now she's an influencer in what we call, you know, earned media. When, you know, she does something that's newsworthy, and then she not only gets the excitement and the rush of her viral spread of her information on TikTok or on the social platforms, but it becomes newsworthy and you and I are talking about it here, and it's been on, you know, other like traditional news sources as well.
And Karen, one lesson from the Conway case that we just heard is something that broadcasters know from day one in the biz. Even if a microphone or a camera looks like it's off, always assume that it is 100% on, because those mics and cameras on those people's cell phones that can actually, you can't actually tell when they're recording. So what does that mean for how people act in public and how it plays out on social?
I mean, it's, you know, it's got the real advantage that it makes the world a little bit more transparent, and we can see people's bad behaviors and their good behaviors when they're not, you know, sort of promoting or creating a persona for the cameras. But at the same time, we have to remember that what is captured on video by somebody's phone does not necessarily tell the whole story. Usually enough has happened prior to the camera being turned on that somebody thinks, I should start videotaping this because it looks like there's going to be something problematic or exciting here. But the reality is that we're all walking around with basically, you know, high resolution, you know, production quality cameras and broadcast systems in our pockets.
And it's important. You mentioned how, you know, the camera can tell one side of the story only. On TikTok, the videos are only 60 seconds long. So, I mean, there is a danger of really not knowing what happened, like as you said, before that event and then after that event.
And the other thing is that with TikTok in particular, it's really coded. It's created in order to spread more rapidly and more broadly than most other networks. It collects data. It uses data and algorithms to try to spread things. And so that's why so many people have emerged as influencers, like lucrative money-making influencers on TikTok, is that the actual app is developed in a way that helps spread things and encourages more and more eyeballs on each post or each person.
Yeah, the viral threads don't necessarily have to be true, but as you said, they're spread so quickly through the algorithm that they feel true.
And, you know, we all grew up, I mean, those of us who are old enough, we grew up in a world where we watched and listened to or read news, and then we came together with like-minded people to develop our opinions. And that hasn't completely gone by the wayside, but a lot of people now receive the news in the form of an opinion. So we receive it from an opinion leader, from a thought leader, or from an influencer, and it's already an opinion. So we sort of, you know, often accept as legitimate what we see, because those are the people that we feel that we're like-minded with, but it may not be accurately representing what happened.
And that happens everywhere but KPCC, Karen, by the way.
Just correct.
That does not happen. We're talking to Karen North, director of the Annenberg Program on Online Communities at USC. In recent months, different groups have used social media to hijack certain narratives. Last week, gay men posted pictures of themselves on Twitter with the hashtag Proud Boys so that it would drown out the content from the actual hate group, the Proud Boys. And in June, K-pop fans and TikTok users from around the world, they booked tickets for a Trump campaign rally in Oklahoma with the intention of not showing up so the event would look like it was a dud. Karen, how do you see those kinds of activist strategies playing out in the years to come? Is that something that political campaigns themselves might try to jumpstart somehow?
I mean, of course, you know, the question is, can strategists be as clever as some kid with a good
idea? Teenager, I know.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, because the thing is that they live on these apps, yeah. So they know exactly how to play with them. There's a great example from this summer where there's a platform called Twitch, which is a gaming, it streams gaming. And Burger King actually went in, and they have a thing in Twitch where you can do little micro donations, just a couple dollars, and it allows you to speak out loud. while somebody's game playing. It's supposed to be so that you could ask questions of the influencer who's playing the game. And Burger King, for like literally dollars, $2 at a time or $3 at a time, got people to talk about Burger King and read menu items, which is against the rules of Twitch because they are sort of a non-advertising situation. But instead of spending thousands of dollars on advertising, they spent dozens of dollars and they gamed the system of this gaming platform. And you just think, who was so clever as to think of, you know, doing that? By the time you get caught, you've already done it. So, you know, it's people are clever.
And you have just promoted our next segment. We're going to talk about exactly that. Exactly that. It's coming up in about 2 minutes. Real quick, one more thing, Karen. Are we past the point of no return on this? Is there any way that people can get political information without being influenced or affected by the warfare waged on social media?
I mean, I want to say yes, but I think the answer is no. I think that for the foreseeable future, we are so in our echo chambers. We're so excited to talk to our like-minded friends that the idea that we would ever get something objective and then think about it and then debate it and then come to a conclusion is an unlikely trajectory. That's old school. The question for a lot of us now is how do we help people learn that when they find something that they feel very strongly about because it was presented strongly and persuasively, that we should backpedal and start analyzing and rethink it to make sure that it's correct. And that's the new game, and it's a very tough one to play.
That's Karen North, director of the Annenberg Program on Online Communities at USC. Karen, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
All right, so as Karen North mentioned, where do influencers go because they can't be influencers anywhere right now because everything's closed? Well, they're going where the eyeballs are, and that is on Twitch, where the gamers are. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. Over the past couple of months, video game sales have accelerated, reaching more than $3 billion in August. Yeah, it seems like the lockdowns have turned more people into gamers. And with that, the live streaming platform Twitch, where people can watch others play video games, has gotten a lot more fans. But gaming isn't the only thing making Twitch a popular place to hang out right now. For more on this, we turn to Cecilia D'Anastasio. She's a staff writer at Wired covering the games industry and gaming culture. Now, Cecilia, how has the pandemic with stay-at-home orders in place impacted the video game industry?
Sure. So being stuck inside without having much to do and having such limited socialization has really bolstered the games industry. Lots of studies have shown that early on in the pandemic, people spent more time on their PCs and their Xboxes and their PlayStations and Switches. And mid-March, the games platform Steam reached an all-time record of 20 million people logged in at the same time. At the same time, a lot of people were playing online games together to kind of meet up, catch up, hang out with their friends. In Fortnite, 12 million people went to go see a Travis Scott concert there. Yeah. And for Twitch, it's been huge. I think viewership has doubled between July last year and July this year.
And those numbers you mentioned, you know, 12 million for the Travis Scott concert, 20 million for the other thing. I mean, that in a time when we are just really starved for a communal experience, this is it. That's a communal experience. That's the biggest one possible right now.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, okay. Now, a big component of this gaming world is live streaming gaming sessions. Now, for those who aren't into this, what's the appeal here of watching other people play video games?
I love this question. I mean, if you have an older sibling, like sitting next to them on the couch and just watching them crush a dungeon in Dark Souls or just get through a Mario level that you thought you could never beat is just so inspiring and cool. And you can talk to Twitch streamers like they're your older sibling or your friend or, you know, even like an acquaintance who you think is really cool. You can interact with them and cheer them on or even heckle them when they don't do something right. it's a fun, interactive experience for people to connect over a medium that they care a lot about.
Cecilia, so when, you know, a million years ago when I was a kid, I was really good at Pac-Man. So I would be on the Pac-Man machine. I wouldn't have lost a life. No lives lost. The bottom is full of keys. I'm beyond like the strawberry and, you know, the banana. I'm at keys, the whole thing. And then to have to go home, the biggest baller thing in the world, Cecilia, is to leave the machine and have someone else play for you because you can't get beat and you have to go home for dinner. So I understand.
Oh my God,
that's a long time ago. I understand the appeal of watching someone and then having someone watch you play video games. Okay, now Twitch, which is an online site that Amazon bought, what, for $970 million in 2014? That's the main place where people stream their games. So what are some of the features that users have on this platform that they can't find necessarily anywhere else?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just to kind of back up a little bit, there are a lot of people out there who have parasocial relationships with celebrities, you know, Brad Pitt, Billie Eilish. But celebrities changed a lot over the last couple of years. We're in an age where anybody can gain a following on any kind of platform and where interaction is a key component of these platforms. So Twitch is a place where gaming celebrities and micro celebrities entertain, you know, live audiences of dozens to thousands, and that audience can react or engage or whatever. And, you know, for non-gamers, it's a popular live streaming platform where they can chat with musicians or chefs or painters. And the thing that distinguishes Twitch, though, from its competitors like Facebook Gaming or YouTube Gaming is that Twitch has kind of had a head start. It was popular earlier on. And it's created its own culture, mostly rooted in gaming, that people kind of engage with through emotes on the platform or slang terms and things like that. So that's what's kept it relevant and its user base huge.
So Cecilia, take us into that for a second. If I were to log on right now, what would I see?
If you were to log on, you would see a couple of really popular streams, probably curated by Twitch on the front page, maybe the video game League of Legends, maybe even like a debate is going on that somebody's broadcasting. The New York Times reported on that recently, people watching the presidential debates on Twitch. You could see any number of people cooking a meal, playing any kind of game you could imagine. You might even see people making video games or painting something live on camera. It's anything you could imagine.
And that is where exactly the allure is for musicians, comedians, politicians. I mean, that's where eyeballs are at right now. So that's where you make your product in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's just where people are, and it makes sense to come to them. I mean, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I think did like a Donkey Kong 64 stream.
I think so. Yeah.
A couple months ago. Yeah. To raise money for a charity. Cause I mean, that's just where people are, and that's how you reach them.
You know, earlier we were talking about activism on other social media sites. So do we see political activism on Twitch? Does that what AOC did? Does that qualify as activism on Twitch?
She was raising money for a charity. We do see people commentating over debates or hosting political debates on the platform, which a lot of people treat more like a sport. In terms of activism specifically, you see people kind of talking through the news. You see people sharing what they think on the topic of the day. You might not see a lot of people kind of live streaming themselves holding a sign at a protest on the same scale as you see some of the other things I mentioned.
So where does this go from here? I mean, just when you think that it can't get any, that the world can't get any bigger, it does. So where does this all go from here? What do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, games are places now. I think that's where it goes. Video games, Twitch, even the chat platform, Discord, all of them are kind of intertwined, and people are living between these gaming services and, you know, meeting in a chat room, playing a game together on Steam, then watching each other stream that game on Twitch. Games and the apps around them are just becoming locations, third places like coffee shops, bars, where people can kind of express themselves and connect. I think that's the direction everything is heading in.
Cecilia D'Anastasio is a staff writer at Wired covering the games industry and gaming culture. Cecilia, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You can find us on social media. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two on Twitter. I'm there as well, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. Good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.